Hello and welcome to a Weekly Stuff bonus podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here after a brief delay to talk about the Eighth Doctor, Paul McGann, and the Big Finish audio story, The Chimes of Midnight.
Yes, it is. We are at the conclusion of a long journey.
Yes.
That was supposed to be 8 months, was nine, but...
It's now ten. Because we did two Fourth Doctor stories.
That's true, yes. So it should have been... We fucked it up in a number of ways, but it's fine.
It's fine.
It's fine.
It will stand in perpetuity. If you have not been following along, this has been a long-promised mini-series project where we are doing a story from each Doctor of the classic Doctor Who series. And then, of course, there is Paul McGann, today's Doctor, who kind of straddles the two eras but must be talked about.
Absolutely.
Because he's one of the fucking best.
Yes.
And we have to go to the world of audio, but we have done the other seven Doctors. This is kind of the last one. We'll talk more about our plans for the future of this later on. This is probably the last one for now, but we promise it will not be the last time we talk about classic Doctor Who.
Obviously. Yes. Yeah, I mean, you're not done with your classic Doctor Who rewatch.
No.
You had to go on hiatus temporarily, so...
I have to get back to it. And now I want to listen to a bunch of Eighth Doctor audios.
This story has that quality to it, for sure.
Yeah, it's like, oh, this is the one where it all snaps into place, isn't it?
Uh-huh, yeah. It's very good. But before we jump into Chimes of Midnight, we need to do our necessary history lecture, or whatever it is that I do here on this podcast about Doctor Who. Because, again, our project is not just to talk about these stories, but also looking at and surveying the history of classic Doctor Who, bringing us now up to basically the eve of Doctor Who being not quite rebooted, but revived on television in 2005. So Chimes of Midnight comes out in 2002, and you know, savvy listeners of this podcast might realize there was maybe a bit of a gap between the Seventh Doctor story we listened to that was made in 1989... and the one that we're talking about that was made in 2002, right?
Yes.
So there's a strong gap of years there. And also, it's like, who the fuck is Paul McGann? Who's this Eighth Doctor dude? Where does he come from? I didn't see that guy on TV, probably. So there's a lot of stuff to talk about before we get to the Chimes of Midnight to just clarify that stuff, because people might not know. So, show is canceled, 1989. Oh, no. Doctor Who's gone. John Nathan Turner and the BBC shot it in the head. It's gone. It's dead. They wrote it into Midnight. Except for Doctor Who has, like, one of, if not maybe the most passionate, rabid fan bases of any television show that has or probably will ever exist. It's like them and, like, The Simpsons or some shit. So fans kept Doctor Who alive for a long time. And this is a stretch that Doctor Who fans either call, like, the dark times or something. I like the term the wilderness years. I think is very evocative. Because sort of what happened was you still had a lot of ancillary Doctor Who media coming out, but obviously the core television series was canceled. So there were lots of novels being written. There was still the Doctor Who magazine. The fan magazine was still coming out at a monthly pace that had like comic books associated with it. There were other comic books. They made a video game somewhere in this period that's like an old weird PC game that is probably terrible. Then there were a series, my favorite bit of history from this period of Doctor Who is the weird fan videos that were put out on VHS that had some of the original actors like Colin Baker and stuff in it, but they couldn't use any of the Doctor Who licensed like terms or characters. So it's like Colin Baker plays the mysterious stranger and Nicola Bryant is his traveling assistant that's not quite named Perry. And so it's like them trying to sort of fans trying to write sort of Doctor Who stories and get some of the Doctor Who actors involved, but not having it be literally Doctor Who. There's a bunch of those from this period. That's where a lot of the people who now work on the show, like Nicholas Briggs, who then eventually becomes a big figure in Big Finish, come out of that sort of like side of the fandom. So one of the other major things that happens, sort of like a big tipping point then, is in 1996, you have the TV movie come out. That's where Paul McGann comes from. So basically what happened was the BBC and Fox, the now part of Disney, Fox. So it's like, I don't know what happened to all these movie rights in America, at least. I know that the BBC has all like the home rights in
this
the
is
UK.
Gonna be weird. I know Warner Brothers released it on DVD because Warner Brothers owns the company that puts out Doctor Who on DVD here.
Yeah.
So it's Take-Two Media, or it's Two Entertain Media in the UK, and they sublicense all their DVDs to WB here, but it comes out under a label. So it's all very weird.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I'm sure like 20 years from now, a good version of the Doctor Who TV movie, sometimes referred to as Enemy Within from the fan base, for whatever reason I always think of it from that title. But that's going to be like a weirdly hard good version of that to find. It'll be like Godzilla 2000 or Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla. It's like, ah, fuck it. Some weird random other production company like Columbia has it over here, and it's like the only one they have. It's just all a mess. But so BBC and Fox kind of partnered up to make an American version of Doctor Who, and they decided instead of completely rebooting the show, it was sort of a soft reboot. So they had Sylvester McCoy's in it. He's in it for the beginning, and he's really good, and he has a good costume because they got rid of all the fucking bullshit question marks. It's got a great version of the opening theme. That's not the one we played, the Big Finish one on this podcast, but that's also a good theme if you want to go find that one.
It's got one of your favorite TARDIS sets.
It's got, yeah, one of the best TARDIS sets. It's gigantic. It's really good. So it's like, it's got some good Doctor Who fan stuff in there. Also, the Seventh Doctor lands in like mid-1990s San Francisco, steps out of the door and gets shot by an Asian gang. So it's just like, that's how he basically regenerates, and it's weird. And so he regenerates into Paul McGann, who's this handsome, young, strapping lad, who luckily they cast a British actor. They were smart enough to do that.
Yes.
Even if it was, you know, it was a joint America and British production.
We did not get George Clooney as Doctor Who.
No, luckily.
Batman was bad enough.
Yeah, we did get Eric Roberts as the Master.
That was bad.
It's really fucking bad. So they didn't have enough wisdom to also cast a British Master, but they got Eric Roberts because he'll show up for anything. And so that movie is rough, but I have a fondness for it. And it was actually reasonably successful and well-received in the UK. It was not over here. So it was this like pilot TV movie that never got picked up for series. They also did a lot of weird bullshit where they like kind of retcon stuff of like the Doctor's dad was named Ulysses and his mom was a human. There's a lot of weird stuff of them trying to sort of change the lore, which is why I kind of think of it as being this soft reboot.
It's the most overtly romantic Doctor.
Yeah,
in that story.
Yeah, it ends with a big cliche like he kisses Grace, the companion from the movie, and it's just like, that's weird and not necessary.
But it's Doctor Who, so it's really easy to hand wave all that away as poster generation hates. He was fucking high off his mind.
Yeah.
And I just, my headcanon is the next day, the Eighth Doctor was like, what did I tell that poor woman from Earth? And then he goes and drops her off at the nearest spaceport and goes ahead and has adventures with Charlie.
Yeah, it's the Doctor's version of a drunk one-night stand.
It really is.
It's just like, oh, fuck, what did I do last night? That was I'm sorry. It's not you. Like, it was just a big mistake.
Was the Master played by Eric Roberts?
It's like, what the fuck? Have you turned into a giant plasma snake? What is going on?
Can I just say one thing about the movie?
Yeah.
The sad thing, though, about the movie, bad, good, whatever, the one sad thing about it to me is that every conversation in some circles about the Eighth Doctor rests on, like, that one movie he did,
uh-huh.
And that is the tiniest, tiniest sliver of what the Eighth Doctor is.
Yeah.
You can completely ignore that and have a great Eighth Doctor experience with so much other stuff. It's not really representative of his take on the character, even.
Yeah, it's not like you need to go watch the TV movie and then listen to his Big Finish audios. It's like, no, fuck that. You
don't. And it's one of the cool things is Big Finish had a... It's the only Doctor they had a clean slate on.
Absolutely, yeah. So,
which we'll get to.
Yeah, which that's a good segue for, because, you know, there's not that much more to talk about that movie. It's an interesting curiosity. If you're a big Doctor Who fan, I recommend watching it just because it's weird. And it's like this brief window into what could have been, you know? Like, I'm glad that it honestly didn't get picked up for series because while I love and I just absolutely adore Paul McGann, a lot of the ideas for that series, I think, were just kind of like wrongheaded. It's very mid-90s, and it's like... It's almost appropriate that Doctor Who was not around for the 90s because that's not a Doctor Who decade. That's
no.
Just like it's not a decade that the show would have thrived in, like the sort of punk attitude thing that the 90s had. It's like the Doctor Who could flourish in the glam like pop sci-fi of the 80s. It could not in the like grungy 90s. Like that just would never have worked, you know.
And I think the right things happened for Paul McGann's Doctor. The right things happened for Doctor Who, the TV show. It all turned out okay in the end.
Yes. And for those who are interested and maybe have forgotten, there is a good chance that if you're a fan of modern Doctor Who, you have seen Paul McGann because he was in the Night of the Doctor 50th anniversary little special mini video they did that's like 5 minutes long that tells how the War Doctor came to be, and he's fucking awesome in that. It's the thing of, like, they should just make another, like, TV special with him or something. Like, get him. He's like, amazing, and I think the best Doctor on audio. He also is really good as the Doctor on video, and it's sad that we have, like, basically about 105 minutes of it. And actually, no, because he's only in about, like, probably two-thirds of the movie.
I just, one day, the next time Doctor Who has to take a year off because someone's busy, just call Paul McGann, get a couple of the Big Finish writers... Call up a good director and just do a 10-episode miniseries of The Eighth Doctor. Just do some adventures with him.
Absolutely.
It would be the best fucking thing.
Yeah, so that's sort of where The Eighth Doctor comes about. After that TV movie, actually, like, in the same year of 1996, is when Big Finish Productions is founded. Big Finish, if you've listened to any of our... Obviously, we've mentioned it a couple of times on this podcast and, like, the other previous ones. And then on our main podcast, The Weekly Stuff, that we also do, I feel like it comes up all the time when we're talking about Doctor Who. And Big Finish is a British audio company that makes radio plays, basically, that are not really... They have some series, from what I understand, that are played on radio stations in the UK, but generally speaking, it's not a... You'll actually listen to them on the radio, but it's kind of... The radio or audio play is kind of a dead... Not totally dead, but mostly dead storytelling form that was a lot more popular in the early 20th century when radio was the thing, you know? Like, you didn't even have TVs. And there's a really interesting long tradition of the radio play. And there's a lot of great, like, Orson Welles, you know, got some of his start in radio plays as well as theater. There's a lot of interesting radio sort of drama content out there. And I encourage people to kind of look up and learn about the form, because it's really fascinating. And so Big Finish kind of came about as this sort of mission statement of, what if we kept this idea alive and sort of worked on it. And they got access to a bunch of different franchises from the BBC, but their main one was Doctor Who. And they got the rights to being able to make Doctor Who audio plays, and they got the original actors, principally for the Doctors and the companion characters, to play their roles. And so that was originally the Fifth Doctor, Sixth Doctor, Seventh Doctor, and then the Eighth Doctor, all like those actors and like most of their companions and the actresses, most of the actresses that played their companions, came back to voice those roles. And the Big Finish just puts out really, really high quality stuff. It's, you know, not all of them are the best, but I would say they probably actually have a slightly higher than, like, batting average than the TV show usually does. And it's, they're really, really, really fucking good. And they get Doctor Who. All the actors are great. And it's just a ton of fun to be able to hear and get, like, more refined versions, particularly of the Fifth and Sixth Doctor, who didn't get, like, the best runs on television, and have those actors, Peter Davison and Colin Baker, get to, like, get some, like, really meaty stories and develop their takes on the character. So Big Finish is awesome. I love all the work they do. They also put out an ungodly amount of material.
Ungodly amount. They have so... I mean, there is more Big Finish Doctor Who than any other Doctor Who. Like, there is...
easily.
Because they have...
Eclipses it.
So they have their main monthly range, which has been going since, like, 2001 or something, right?
Yeah.
And that has 237, I think, at current count, serials. And that's where they... That's 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th Doctor. The 8th Doctor hasn't been there in a while, but they do them in the main range. And then... Each of those Doctors has other, like, sub-series going on. Yep. The Eighth Doctor has been spun off in a bunch of other different directions. They have done series with the Fourth Doctor, Tom Baker. They have done things with First, Second, and Third Doctors via recasting. They currently have a series going on with the Tenth Doctor, David Tennant, mm-hmm. and his companions, which I really want to listen to, but there's no goddamn time. They did the War Doctor with John Hurt while he was still alive. Yep. There are four releases of that.
They're doing the War Master now with their Jacoby taking over. For people who remember, he was briefly played the Master in the third season in the Utopia episode.
Yeah, they're doing a War Doctor prequel series with Eighth Doctor Paul McGann to kind of put a bow on what they've done with him over the years. So, like, it's nuts. All Doctor Who actors apparently now have to do it.
Yep, I mean, there's a River Song one they're doing now. They have the rights to Torchwood now. Because one thing years, I think right around the 50th anniversary is when they got access to... basically up to the 11th Doctor stuff in modern Doctor Who also, because before it was only classic Doctor Who, so they have all of that. They have a bunch of unit stories. They have fucking everything. And actually, what they kind of got started on was a sort of spin-off of Doctor Who in the novels called Bernice Summerfield or Benny Summerfield, which is a sort of, she was never in any of the TV shows, but in one of the novels, she was a sort of like novel companion to, I think, the Seventh Doctor, that then was really popular and got her own spin-off series of novels of her own that then got adapted into audio plays. And that's some of the earliest stuff that they did. And she appears as a companion in some of the Seventh Doctor stuff, which is cool.
Crazy. They've even done a Winston Churchill spinoff with the dude who played him in that one bad Dalek episode.
Yes, and in The Wedding River Song very briefly, lest you forget.
Yes, he's in both of those.
Yes, they have the rights to that, the Dark Shadows thing. That got remade into a movie with Johnny Depp and all that shit. Charlotte Pollard has her own spin-off series now, the companion from the early Eighth Doctor stuff that we'll talk about. They just have a lot, is the point.
Yes.
So, Big Finish is awesome. I highly recommend checking out some of their back catalog, because if you, you know, listen to The Chimes of Midnight, you know you can get some of their early stuff really cheap for like $1 or $2, and so a lot of it is really, really great. Also, during this time, don't want to forget that there's other Doctor Who stuff that was going on before 2005, including more novels, more comic books, and when the Eighth Doctor thing happened, that became like the canonical new, like, most recent Doctor, even though the TV show never took off. So he became the Doctor in the, like, ongoing novels, in the comic books. So the Eighth Doctor is by far the Doctor that has the most stories told about him, the longest living, longest running, because he runs from 1996 to 2005. So he's got a solid 9 years. And it's the Eighth Doctor is in many ways the most interesting Doctor to be a big fan of, because you have a lot of different interpretations and versions of him to go seek out should you wish to. So
yeah, even if you just follow, because I was counting all these because I'm planning to do more listening to the Eighth Doctor stuff, and I was just trying to make a list of all of the Eighth Doctor stories in the main range so I know which ones to get, because I know he's also one of the more there's an ongoing story with him, obviously, and which you can hear in The Chimes of Midnight. And I was just making a list, and I'm like, good God, he has a lot, even if you just do this one sliver of it.
Yeah, like, because then eventually they start doing miniseries like Dark Eyes and stuff like that with him instead of just the monthly stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
because his run in the monthly range roughly ends when Charlie leaves. Like, he has a couple past her I was looking at, but, like, mostly in that it's him and Charlie, and then all the other stuff is other stuff.
Yes, then they do the new Doctor, the new Eighth Doctor Adventures, which is, like, a different sort of modern Doctor Who format of 45-minute episodes, which is pretty good. And then they start doing, like, crazy box sets and stuff. I haven't really gotten into that side of it yet. But yeah, that's the run-up to this story. So there have been a number of, let's see, there's been 5 Eighth Doctor dramas before this one. So this is the 6th Eighth Doctor audio drama. So there's a little bit of backstory to this. And as you said, because the Eighth Doctor was a, like, level playing field, they could do whatever they wanted with him. There was no existing companions really to use other than Grace, or they could have from the movie, or they could have brought some of the comic book characters that they kind of reference in some of them. But generally they're like, no, we're going to start our own new story. So in the first Eighth Doctor story, they called Storm Warning, they introduce Charlotte Pollard, who is our companion for this, like, long stretch with the Eighth Doctor. And she is an Edwardian adventuress, as she styles herself, from around the, I think, like, very pre-World War I, or, like, right at the beginning of World War I.
And he meets her in 1930.
Okay, so it's post-World War I. It's in that sort of, like, early 20s. That's right, this story takes place
in 1906.
Yeah,
because I've listened to some other ones. Yeah. Her being from 1930 is a big plot point.
Yes, that's true.
She's going to Singapore, and she gets on the R101 in Storm Warning.
Right, because the reason why she calls herself an Edwardian adventuress is not because she's actually from the Edwardian period, is because she read novels from the Edwardian period. That's right, that's a mistake.
They bond early on. One of the ways they characterize Paul McGann's Doctor early on is his love of literature.
Yeah.
Where you can just imagine him on that movie TARDIS set with, like, the big bookshelves and everything. Mm-hmm. And he's, like, reading Jules Verne and stuff, and she's super into Jules Verne. And that's, like, how she understands the TARDIS in their first meeting. So,
yeah. And the Eighth Doctor has this, while they didn't make him necessarily like kissy-kissy romantic, he's romantic in the, like, classical
sense. He's large R romantic.
Yes, he's capital R romantic. He likes to go on big adventures, and he has his big sweeping, like, Elizabethan garb and his, like, long cloak and all that stuff. And he has his nice flowing locks that were a wig that, if you ever read or hear an interview of Paul McGann talking about the movie, he fucking hated that wig. I've seen so many interviews with him where he tells the story of that he really wanted to be a sort of skinhead looking doctor that had like a shaved head and is like, no, you can't do that. Like you have to have like long flowing tresses. And then of course in 2005 when they bring it back, Christopher Eccleston has basically a shaved head with like a little bit of like fuzzy hair.
Yeah.
That's it. It's like, motherfucker. It's like, I was like a 10 years too early. Motherfucker. But yeah, so that's sort of how they characterize him. So they bond over that. They have a pretty tight connection. But as what becomes important in the Chimes of Midnight, she's on the, what is it, like the R-101 or whatever it is.
The R-101.
Yeah, the airship that is destroyed. And she is supposed to die in a horrible flaming death on this like Hindenburg-esque Zeppelin.
And this is the plot of his first story, Storm Warning, just to be clear. Yeah.
And he decides, nah, fuck it, you know. She seems kind of cool. I'm the doctor. I'm going to save her.
Yeah.
And so he saves her and takes her on as a companion, even though he knows that she... they hadn't used the like fixed point time terminology that comes from the 2005 series, but it's basically that fixed point time concept of like, she's really supposed to die. You're really not supposed to save her, but you kind of did anyways, and there's going to be consequences.
The way the Eighth Doctor does it is he's basically like the Tenth Doctor without the angst.
Yes, he's the Tenth Doctor with, like, a emotional maturity to him.
He's much more jolly about breaking the rules of time.
Yes, it's the web of time, as he calls it. I always love that's such an Eighth Doctor thing. I think they kind of use that in the movie where they kind of pull it from. It's like, it's the web of time. No other Doctor really refers to it that way. I like it. So anyways, that catches us up to the Chimes of Midnight. And this is where we also have to now address that. I've listened to it 3 times. But the last time I listened to it was now like a month ago when we were originally supposed to record this podcast and Jonathan just randomly decided on his own. Now we're not going
to
talk about
it. I didn't randomly decide on my own. I didn't have time to do it. I think I let you know the first time. No, I didn't.
I very distinctly recall listening to that story, expected to talk about it on the podcast, and you just being like, I didn't listen to it. So what the fuck are you talking about? You didn't listen to it.
Well, you know, things happen, Sean. Life happens. Yes, this has been a much delayed podcast because I also, as soon as I got over here tonight to your house, I realized I'd left my computer at home, which is important because that's where we record the podcast.
Yes, we can't just sort of like do the podcast and transcribe it by hand while we're saying it.
No, we cannot. So yeah, this podcast, you know, took a little while to happen, but it's finally happened. I listened to it this week.
Good.
You listened to it a couple weeks ago.
Yes. So I think I might have... I remember enough of the plot that I can still do this conversation, but I might want to have you take a bit of this lead.
That's okay.
Because I think the specific chronological order might be slightly mixed up in my memory at this
point. Ooh, can I take the lead for a second then?
Yes,
and describe what the Chimes of Midnight is about?
Yes.
One thing to note before we even talk about that is that Big Finish, by virtue of being these are audio stories...
Yeah.
They don't always, but they get to do things that you would never do on TV.
Yeah, because you don't need all the special effects. You don't need to do any of like the actual like moneyed work to like realize it visually. You can just describe it to people.
Exactly. And, you know, I actually, from the ones I've heard, which is really only Eighth Doctor stuff, the best stories to me tend to be ones where I think they go beyond what the TV show could do, either in terms of scale, like Storm Warning would be really hard to do.
Yes.
They've done things kind of like it in the modern series now, and I think effects maybe have caught up, but certainly in the early 2000s, you were not doing Storm Warning. The Chimes of Midnight is extremely conceptual, and you would never be able to do it on TV unless you went for like a heaven-sent kind of, we are shooting for the sun on this one.
Yeah.
But it would be a big event if you were to do it. The ones that I find a little more dull are when it's kind of just a Doctor Who story.
Yeah.
Without the visual element. Like, there's one called Sword of Orion, which is his second story.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been the bane of my existence in listening to Eighth Doctor stuff, because I will start the series, get through Storm Warning, listen to an episode of Sword of Orion, and want to kill myself because it is so fucking boring. And then I will leave it for several months, go back and feel like, I'll just start at the beginning again. And I run on that hamster wheel a little bit. So, finally, this time I've skipped ahead and just went to The Stones of Venice, which is his third story.
Yeah,
and it's pretty good.
Yeah, that one's better.
Anyway, but yeah, so back to Chimes of Midnight, though. When I'm describing this, this is not going to sound like any other Doctor Who story.
Yeah.
One thing I do like about Big Finish is they structure, at least in the main range, their stories as four-parters,
mm-hmm.
like the classic series.
Yeah, with like cliffhangers, and they like play the end theme and the opening theme and everything.
Yep.
Yeah,
they're usually about 30 minutes long, so it's like very similar to the pace of Classic Who, which, as we have talked about a lot over these last 8 episodes, works really well. And it gives you these internal like build-ups, climaxes, resolutions, and you don't have to stretch it out as long. And I think Chimes of Midnight is one that uses it really well, because each of the 4 episodes, it's an ongoing story, but it kind of resets like where we are and what our understanding of it is every time.
Yeah.
Because the first episode is the Doctor and Charlie, that the Doctor decides, I'm just going to let the TARDIS fly itself. I'm not going to pick where we go.
There's a really good conversation about him just being like, you know, I've been too like picky about where we're going. There was a time when the TARDIS just went wherever the fuck it wanted, and I just was along for the ride. You know what? Let's do that.
And Charlie is like in disbelief about this because she's like, but you haven't gotten us anywhere we wanted to go yet, Doctor. Yeah. And he's like, no, I've been trying. So this time they arrive in basically a cellar.
Yeah.
Not a celery.
There that might be some celery in the cellar.
There might be. There's a thing about jam, but it's totally dark. They finally find a light, but it's very eerie. It's like everything is frozen. Charlie breaks a jar of jam, and then it just reassembles. It's like they cannot affect time. And meanwhile, a story is going on in the same space, but in a different time, with this woman named Edith Thompson, who is the scullery maid. That word is said so much in this story.
It's a very good word. It's a good word. Even though it's a shitty job, this episode makes it very clear it's a shitty job to have. It's a good job title.
It is.
Like, I would not mind having a business card that said Sean Chapman, Scullery Maid.
Sadly, I don't think Scullery Maids get business cards.
Well, you know, there's some fucking social change that needs to happen.
Absolutely. I'm in favor of it. I just don't think it does. Anyway, but yes, Edith Thompson, she's the scullery maid. She is picked on by everyone else in the household. Basically, the Doctor has stumbled into the saddest episode of Downton Abbey ever made.
Yeah.
Because it's all about, like, the downstairs people, and it's Christmas Eve, and the cook is making her famous plum pudding, because it wouldn't be Christmas without her plum pudding.
Mrs. Baddeley's plum pudding.
Mrs. Baddeley's plum pudding, also said a million times. And anyway, over the course of this story, so the Doctor and Charlie are stuck in this one, like, frozen time. Charlie can hear Edith Thompson a couple of times, and Edith can hear Charlie a little bit, but they are separated. In the second episode, the two stories converge, and the Doctor and Charlie are allowed by some mysterious force into this time. In 1906, Christmas Eve, something is going on, and Edith Thompson has been mysteriously murdered, and everyone in the house thinks the Doctor and Charlie are from Scotland Yard.
Yes, amateur sleuths.
Amateur sleuths from Scotland. Not at first. First they think they're from Scotland Yard, then they think they're amateur sleuths, and they have to try to solve the murder. And what becomes clear over the course of the story is that they are stuck in a two-hour time loop where at 10 p.m., someone is murdered, usually Edith Thompson. At 11 p.m., someone is murdered. And at 12, the chime of midnight, everything restarts. And they have to figure out why this is going on in this household and what is going on with Edith Thompson, what connection she has to Charlie Pollard. It is both a brilliant, bold, completely format-breaking standalone Doctor Who story and also a key piece of the arc with the Doctor and Charlie, where it finally becomes clear to the Doctor what he may have done by pulling Charlie out of her timeline.
Yes. That's a really good sort of summary of the story. And
I've been thinking about it, because it's a hard one to summarize.
Yeah, it's a lot to get your head around. It's something that's like, it's nice that I've listened to it a couple of times now, because I've noticed different things about it each time I've listened to it. And it's a really remarkable story for a lot of reasons. It's written by Robert Shearman, who people might know of. He wrote Dalek from series one with Christopher Eccleston, which is like one of, if probably not, I would say, the best episode of that season.
One of the best episodes of Modern Who. I mean,
yeah, it's really, really fucking good. And he's written a couple of other Big Finish audios, particularly for me, Scherzo, which is another, that's like a key Eighth Doctor Charlie episode, where the Eighth Doctor and Charlie are the only like speaking characters in that whole story. That one's so good. So he's a great, 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 great writer for Big Finish. And so he has this really good sense of what is so hard to do with these audio plays, which is being able to like establish the setting and tone and plot entirely through dialogue. Because Big Finish, generally, there are a couple of stories that kind of break this rule, but generally speaking, the main range Doctor Who stories do not have any sort of narrator. So they don't stop and say, like, and then the Doctor and Charlie walked into the... which is something that some radio plays do. Instead, they try to convey everything through dialogue and then, like, incidental sound effects and music, which play a good part in sort of helping establish the setting and the sense of space. But that first episode in particular is just, I think, a master example of how you do all those things of setting up a plot, establishing characters, and really importantly, establishing a tone and setting entirely through dialogue between just two characters, because it's either the Doctor and Charlie, or in the other timeline, it's Edith and Mr. Shaughnessy. I think Mrs. Badley kind of comes in a little bit, yeah. but it's mostly Edith and Shaughnessy. And that's something that the rougher Big Finish audios, the things that tend to make them kind of rough, is they can be hard to follow if the setting has not been established properly. And there's so much time spent in that first like 30 minutes of really getting the sense of this is this space these people are in. Like you know, they use good like sort of audio engineering techniques to make it feel like when the Doctor and Charlie are in that really cramped closet or the scullery or whatever, like that's they feel tight and claustrophobic. And when like the jam jar breaks on the ground, the glass shattering, all that, they do a really great job of getting you in that setting.
I feel like I watched this. Like, I yeah. we're talking about it now, and I just... everything we're talking about, I am seeing in my head. I have... Like, Paul McGann is easy. I know what Paul McGann looks like, because he's also kind of a famous actor outside of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
But, like, India Fisher, who plays Charlie Pollard, I don't know what she looks like, but I have an image of Charlie. Mm-hmm. I have an image of the other characters. Most importantly, I have an image of that space. I just know what it... I think this has a very blue color scheme to it.
Yeah.
Very dark color scheme. Like, I just... It's all there in my head. And it's amazing to step back and think, but I didn't watch any of this. It's completely yeah. audio.
And it's the thing that is so fun about these audio dramas is that when they work really well, they play on your imagination the way that a novel does. So yeah. it's that kind of thing of like, we both obviously have like really vivid recreations of the setting in our mind, but they're probably very different looking.
Yeah.
So it's like, and it's something that's like, one of the reasons why I make the novel comparison is that this is the third time I listen to the story, and every time I listen to it, it's like I go back into that space,
yep.
and it is the same space, the way that if you reread a novel, it's like this, I'm like back in like the countryside in Frankenstein, because I've read that novel like four times. Every time I read it, like the characters look the exact same to me, the settings look the exact same to me, because I've already created that sort of imaginative space in my head, and the radio plays work in that same sort of like area, and it takes a real skill of writing to be able to communicate that entirely through dialogue between characters. And that is, again, that first episode does such a good job of getting the sense of that darkness and like the isolation, both the isolation for the Doctor and Charlie in this weird frozen time, and then the isolation for Edith being the scullery maid, just like being shit on everyone else, even though like everyone else is also the help. She's, yeah. like, at the bottom rung of the ladder of the help, because there's, like, really good sort of evocative bit of writing of them always talking about, like, the upstairs people that never sort of enter the picture for reasons that become more clear. But it is just, like, you are with the help, and you are down here in this shit-ass fucking cellar and scullery and basement, and everything is terrible and dark and bleak and unpleasant, and all that is communicated through the writing.
Can I just say one thing about Robert Sherman really quick?
Sure.
You listed off a couple of his stories. It is uncanny if you look at his list of Big Finish stories. He only has like 7 or 8, but they are like to a name. These are ones I have heard of. Like he has by far the two most famous Eighth Doctor stories, Scherzo and Chimes of Midnight, which you said. He did The Holy Terror, which is the early Sixth Doctor one that introduces Frobisher, the penguin, to Big Finish. I think he'd been in the comic books.
Yes, he is in a comic character. He's a shape-shifting penguin. For people who don't know how good non-TV Doctor Who can be.
Yeah. And then Jubilee, which is also a Sixth Doctor one, which was reworked into the episode Dalek. So, like, all the ones that you have mentioned on, like, previous episodes, other than, like, maybe spare parts, but a lot of the ones you've been mentioning for other Doctors, he wrote a lot of these.
Yes.
Which is kind of amazing.
Robert Sherman, like, 2 thumbs up.
Yes.
Very, he very good.
Come back and write for the show.
Yeah, that would be nice. Come on. You know, we're getting a bunch of new writers in. We also can get, like, a good old favorite back.
Yes, that'd be great.
Yeah. Back to part one. One little thing I want to kind of zoom in on, which is one of my favorite parts of the beginning of this story, is Edith writing her name in the dust is so evocative. It's such a good bit of, like, character establishing for who Edith is, that she is this very sort of naive, sweet young woman that... you know, is completely uneducated, has no idea how to read, no idea how to write. Mr. Shaughnessy, who's kind of like the butler, so he's kind of at the top of the, like, underrung or whatever of the ladder. He's the best of the help, sort of figuratively speaking. He knows how to read and write, and he kind of writes her name in the dust and says, that's your name, that's Edith. And that is one of the things that gets transferred into the frozen time that the Doctor and Charlie are in. And that's... something about this story is that it is It can be very funny, and I want to talk about some of the humor, but it's also, like, really creepy. It's incredibly creepy, and it, like, sets that just, like, haunting atmosphere of, like, again, thinking about, like, the visual elements of seeing that, like, the name in the dust just appear without anybody drawing it that Charlie sees of Edith is frightening.
It's creepy, it's funny, it's also sad, and yeah. it foregrounds that sadness pretty early on with how it characterizes Edith Thompson. But yeah, I mean, that first episode, you're right, it's just, it, I remember listening to the whole thing being like, I genuinely don't know where this is going. Mm-hmm. And I've seen a lot of Doctor Who, you've seen even more Doctor Who.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've still seen more Doctor Who than I have of most shows or any pieces of fiction.
Yeah, most shows that you can see.
Right, exactly. And so, it's pretty rare I encounter a Doctor Who story and I just genuinely don't know where it's going. It's like, they're going to run down a corridor, and they're going to confront the bad guy, and they're going to get captured and put in a cell, and then the Doctor's going to get out through ingenuity, and they're going to solve the day. Like, right?
Yeah.
This is so not that. Like, so not that. And it even breaks a, like, fundamental convention in episode 3, which we'll get to. Mm-hmm. But, like, it's really, that whole first episode, I'm like, where the hell is this going? Whole second episode, where the hell is this going? You start to have your legs under you in episode 3, but even when you get to episode 3 and you get to the episode 3 climax, and then it's, you're going into episode 4, I'm like, I don't know how they're going to wrap this up. I don't know what the ending is. I don't know how they're going to tie all these things together. I think something's up between Edith and Charlie, but I have like 5 different theories and they can't all be right.
Yeah.
So like, it is really a good story in terms of keeping you on your toes, and it just, it plays with form so much while also telling this coherent story that engages with tone so much, as you're saying, with the humor and the sadness and the creepiness, and engages with space. And it is a good just Doctor Who haunted house story. Yeah. On some level. Like, the last one we talked about for the Seventh Doctor was Ghostlight. This is a good companion to Ghostlight.
Yes, yeah, I think I mentioned that when we talked about that story, Liz. Like, yeah. these go well together, because I really like haunted house Doctor Who stories. They have a really good track record. Modern Doctor Who has kept that up.
Yep.
Yeah, and this is definitely one of those. Another part of part one, sort of like on all of that stuff of like how good the plot and like sort of like building that stuff is in the story, is in part one all the things that like the little things the Doctor does to try to like test the space that they're in, of like they go up to the fire and they're like trying to burn things, or they pop the Christmas poppers and the Christmas poppers go back but the paper still has fallen out, so it's like the popper restores itself and like presumably regenerates more paper inside of it, but the paper that has fallen out has already fallen out, and it's like testing the limits of the sort of cause-effect loop of this weird frozen time they're in. All of those little things do so much to help build the tension and give you a sense of what are the rules we're playing in. Because as you said, this is very unlike other Doctor Who stories, especially like up till now. Because I think the closest analogs I can think of are like some of the more experimental Stephen Moffat episodes, like A Heaven Sent, which like Heaven Sent has a couple of similarities to this in a number of ways. But like when you're listening to this, like as I did, like before getting to any of that stuff, it like is really different. It's really focused on sort of playing with time mechanics and playing with like the larger scale storytelling structure of the story in a way that classic Doctor Who very rarely ever did.
Yeah, I mean, that alone, if you've been enmeshed in classic Doctor Who, which almost never plays with time travel logic, time travel is just the thing that gets us places.
Yeah.
You know, I think the only one of the stories we've talked about where time travel becomes a plot mechanic is City of Death, where yeah. he has to go back and he doesn't meet Leonardo da Vinci, but you know, he has to go to his workshop, all of that. This is a huge leap forward. Some of its stuff is fairly familiar if you've watched Modern Who, especially Moffat has that same taste for playing with, you know, time loops and time mechanics and stuff. But yeah, if you had never watched Doctor Who and were following along with our different stories we've been doing, this is a huge leap forward in like imagining what Doctor Who can do with that stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it really becomes a leap forward in that second episode.
Yes.
When it becomes this time loop, it becomes apparent that at midnight someone is going to get murdered. I like that Robert Shearman doesn't try to trick us, really, with, like, that this is something is up. Like, as soon as the Doctor and Charlie start interviewing the different suspects and everything, it's very clear something is wrong. We're not sure, are they, like, automatrons or something? Are they robots? Is this an experiment? Is this, like, an illusion that they're seeing? There's all sorts of possibilities.
Yeah.
But it becomes clear something is fucked up. The different characters are replying in, like, weird circular ways where every character will say about another one, I think it's them. They have shifty eyes. Yeah. There's all of that. And, like, Charlie and the Doctor split up for a little bit and they each come to the same conclusions. Like, this is really fucked up. Something is wrong. Like, the characters insist that Edith Thompson and then later Mrs. Baddeley have committed suicide when they have died in ways. And each time they die, it becomes more apparent that, you could not possibly commit suicide this way.
Yeah.
Like, one time she has a plunger stuck on her face.
Yeah, and that's where some of the humor comes in of the doctor, like, pulling off the plungers. I think it's, like, the second time this line has come around because, again, Robert Sherman plays with, like, the repetition of these different sort of automaton humans shifting in these roles and repeating the same lines with, like, different sort of, like, you know, Mad Libs style, like, replacement words. And the doctor is like, it must have been suicide. The doctor says, I hardly think it's possible to commit suicide with a plunger to the face. It's like, well, Edith wasn't the brightest person in the world. She probably didn't know it was impossible to kill yourself with a plunger.
Yes, which is playing off the, you probably didn't know it was impossible to drown yourself, which is the first time. But yes, it's... So it's really interesting. Like, Robert Sherman makes it clear. It's not like he does a big part one where it's like, it could go either way, which kind of can be annoying if you know the conventions of these stories.
Yeah.
It's very clear. The mystery is not really who killed any of these people. The mystery is what force is manipulating all of this.
Yeah, exactly. It's not who is killing who, because that becomes, like, completely irrelevant by the time the first cycle begins again, because they're all alive again. It's, like, why are people being killed at all? Like, what the fuck is even happening? What is with frozen time? Why is there a time loop? And it's like, the murder mystery is this weird sort of, like, bubble narrative within the larger narrative that's being told that the main villain is sort of trying to construct and have all the different characters play their roles and incorporating the Doctor and Charlie into that.
Yes. But within these episodes, like, there are so many creepy scenes, funny scenes, some that are both. The one that, like, just was, I found, searingly creepy is all the stuff between Charlie and Mrs. Baddeley, who is the cook. It's where she sits. So Charlie goes to interview Mrs. Baddeley, and it starts out kind of normal, even though Mrs. Baddeley is, like, she is such that, like, British maid cook stereotype of, like, hello, poppet, that kind of thing. And she's made her plum pudding, which wouldn't be Christmas without Mrs. Baddeley's plum pudding. And she's going to give Charlie a piece, and Charlie eats it and then, like, regresses in age and becomes, like, a little girl. And Mrs. Baddeley is being all motherly, saying, there, this was always your favorite poppet. And it just... the creepiness of some of the stuff that goes on, in part because you really have no idea. Like, this one... like, I would say that early Eighth Doctor stories that I've heard generally kind of do the thing where you're sort of more in Charlie's shoes than you are in the Doctor's.
Yeah.
She's kind of our entry point. And you get that here where, like, I think the Doctor is very confused by this situation, but he still has a slightly more tenuous grasp on reality here than Charlie does, who is really freaked out, as well she should be, because weird shit is going on. And, you know, we can talk about the different characters later, but Charlie is... part of why this is a great Doctor Who story is Charlie is an all-time great companion.
Absolutely. And it is that, like, that sense of mystery, particularly in the first three parts before the true nature of the villain has been revealed, of the sense that she is being absorbed by whatever is controlling this house. And it is just like that whole scenario is so fascinating and so compelling to me on so many levels of... having the sort of, like, clockwork roles of all the different people, like, these, like, very working class roles in this big manor that are just sort of pushed around, and they're all basically replaceable with each other. It doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter if Mr. Shaughnessy is the butler, really. I mean, he's the one that is most fixed, but it's like, it doesn't matter if Edith is a scullery maid and Mrs. Baddeley is the cook,
well,
and
they
Frederick
do
is the driver and Mary is the lady's maid or whatever.
Because they do this whole thing where Mary gets demoted to scullery maid when Edith is killed, and then they forget there ever was another scullery maid.
Yeah.
It's a very creepy subplot going on.
Yeah, and so, like, some of them are sort of quietly being pushed into different roles of, like, that it's not important who Mary and Frederick and Edith are, really. Like, all that is important is the job that they're performing in the house. And then that, like, their interpersonal relationships are, like, interesting and, like, soap opera-esque between, particularly, like, Frederick and Mary have their weird sort of, like, romance thing that Frederick's like, no, we can't, like, we, whoever heard of a lady's maid and a, or it's like the lady's maid and the driver, eventually she gets demoted to the scullery maid. It's like, a driver and a scullery maid can't be together. Like, that's ridiculous. That's absurd. And it's just that sense of how insignificant the individual is in the house, and that they are just being absorbed into these roles that the house has created for them, is very disturbing. And that's one of the things that then starts playing on Charlie, is that she is getting fitted into one of those roles and being transformed in the ways that all of them are being transformed. So it's like Mary herself forgets that she was ever a lady's maid and just eventually adopts naturally the role of scullery maid is the kind of thing that you get the impression that should this cycle keep on going on, all of them will have switched every single role an infinite number of times because it's not important.
Yep.
If it, any sort of inciting incident that will push them in one direction, they'll just occupy that role until something else pushes them somewhere else.
It's a really trenchant, like, social commentary going on in this. And I think one of the most impressive things about the story is that not only do the sci-fi mechanics not undermine it, like, they don't take away from that analysis. I would say in the end, with the revelations you get in the last episode about who Edith Thompson is, why all this happened, they become even more relevant than ever. Like, the themes are really crucial, where it feels like part of why you tell the story this way is because these are themes you want to tackle. And of course, tackling the kind of horrificness of the British caste system in these ways is not necessarily a new thing to explore, but it is interesting when, like, it's a pretty consistent thing where we have shows come out that basically glorify this.
Yeah.
Like, in the 90s, I think there was a show called, like, Upstairs, Downstairs or something on... I mean, there's always one of these on British television. Yeah. The most famous recent example I joked about earlier is Downton Abbey, which, you know, if you're listening to this in a post-Downton Abbey world, that's kind of... Maybe that's one of the images running in your head. But, like... Even if those shows are vaguely critical of the system, they are clearly clearly old British white guys nostalgic for the time when they could order around poor people, you know? And, like, this is one of those that's like, this is really fucked up and, most importantly, as you were talking about, dehumanizing. And the sense of dehumanization going on here, not just within the sci-fi story going on, but the idea that, oh, they would kind of be this dehumanized even if they weren't stuck in a two-hour time loop for infinity... That's the scary part.
Yeah, that it's the kind of thing that, you know, there have been a lot of different pieces of media that criticize the British caste system, but it's very rare, or can't think of anyone that, like, tackles it quite this way in, like, using this very sort of complicated but ultimately, like, logical frame narrative with, like, sci-fi fantasy elements to, like, really kind of get at the essence of what is happening when you treat people this way, and that you treat people as disposable when you completely ignore their sort of autonomy as being an individual and you pit them against each other. So it's like the working class people are all fighting with each other basically because there's a caste system within their caste system, and the butler's at the top and under him is like the lady's maid is kind of like up there, and the cook's kind of up there, and the driver, and then the scullery maid is at the bottom. And so it's like, you know, shit rolls downhill and it all lands in Edith's lap, right? Because she's at the very bottom rung of the ladder, and so she is the one that takes the brunt sort of oppression and bullying and harassment from everything. Like, until it like, ultimately find out that it broke the real Edith Thompson.
Well, do you want to talk about that, where the plot kind of goes?
Sure.
Because it is such a dark plot turn. Well, before that, I want to talk about the cliffhanger of the third episode.
Okay, yeah.
Because this part blew me away, where... Because I honestly don't think I've seen a Doctor Who story, and you can correct me if maybe there is one I've seen, where this happens, where the Doctor... Like, usually a Doctor Who story is, no matter how fucking dangerous it gets... The Doctor lands in the TARDIS, they go out, and you just... Maybe you see the TARDIS again if he has to run in and do something crazy in it, but generally, he goes back to the TARDIS when the story is over and the thing is done with, and people just conveniently don't ever talk about, usually, that he has an easy out. You know, like, in Tomb of the Cybermen, there's not even, like, a excuse given for why he can't go back to the TARDIS. It's just, it's understood, like... Even though this situation is crazy dangerous and the Doctor and his companions are probably all going to get murdered, he's not going to run away to the TARDIS. He's going to stay and see this out.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of an unwritten rule of Doctor Who, right?
Yeah.
In this story, it gets so creepy and it seems so impossible and the rules of time themselves are bending so much that the Doctor gets frightened enough that he says, "Charlie, let's get back to the TARDIS. We're leaving." And she's like, "But what about these people?" And he's like, "I don't know. I can't help them. We have to fucking go." And they go back to the TARDIS and leave. Now, they don't successfully leave because everything, like the time vortex around them, like envelops the TARDIS and all this stuff. But just that is what an episode builds to, of the Doctor being like, "We're leaving. I can't figure this out. We're done." That is amazing to me. And they sell it so well.
Yeah, I don't think that's ever happened in anything else. Like, that's a good point. That I hadn't quite thought of, like, how utterly unprecedented it is. Because it is just, like, Paul McGann's just straight up like, no, fuck this. Like, this is too... Like, the scale of what is happening here is too big.
Yes.
Like, it's not... Because, again, especially, like, up till this point, the Doctor doesn't deal with other, like, people fucking with time. He's the dude that's fucking with time, and then maybe the Master does a little bit sometimes. And that's, like, it. Or, like, the weird time-meddling monk for the first Doctor. Like, there's a handful. There's, like, the War Games with the second Doctor. There's a little couple throughout, like, the whole history of classic Doctor Who. But generally speaking, the Doctor is the one, he's the Time Lord in the situation. He knows what's going on with time. He lands wherever, whatever the fuck is going on. And if there's any, like, weird time bullshit going on, like in the Time Warrior, he knows way more about it than anybody else in the situation does. Like it's the same thing with City of Death. He knows way more about time travel than, like, the Scaroth or whatever his name is, right? It's,
yeah.
You're never worried about that side of it. You're never worried that, like, the scale of the threat is so powerful that the Doctor would never be able to do anything against it, reasonably speaking, based on, like, the information you're presented. It's always, like, it's, a, like, a you know, a staunch foe that we've encountered here. Like, the Daleks are our tough enemies, but we can still deal with the Daleks. This is a situation where it's like, there's nothing you can do. We're just caught in this crazy time loop. There's no, like, physical, like, there's nobody standing in front of me that I get to, like, lecture at and tell, like, this is how we're, like, I'm going to convince you to, like, fix this problem, because everybody else, like, forgets everything that happens as soon as the time loop resets. So it's like, we have to just go. There's nothing he can do.
Yeah, usually it's something like the City of Death, where if he uses the TARDIS mid-episode, it's to accomplish some sub-goal of the plot.
Yeah.
Which Modern Who does that a lot. It still doesn't break that general tenet of he abandons the story midstream.
Yeah.
You know? Sometimes he may want to, but the TARDIS is, like, out of bounds or something. But it just really, I was like, wow, that is intense. And it's part of it is Paul McGann's performance, because he is an extremely composed, confident Doctor.
Yeah.
Like, he does have, as you say, that big R romantic quality where he's kind of this, he feels like it's kind of this, like, very upright swashbuckler who does not really get phased all that easily.
He's a dashing hero, you know?
Yes. But this is one where he's like, I'm scared, Charlie. I don't understand what's going on. And so you go into that last episode with the Doctor, like, you usually think the Doctor has some card in his pocket that he has yet to play. And he usually does, right?
Uh-huh.
He's very rarely completely, like, on his own at wit's end. In this one, he goes into that last episode just like, we might be here forever, Charlie. I don't know. Let's see if we can figure it out. And then that last episode is divided into this confrontation with Edward Grove, which the name has been teased throughout. And it turns out the house itself is alive. It has been animated by a paradox in time, where what we learn is because Charlie is supposed to be dead from the R101 disaster. And when Charlie dies, Edith Thompson, we find out, was the scullery maid. Well, she was this in 1906, she's the scullery maid here. She did rise up through the ranks, though, and in Charlie's household in 1930, she is the cook who makes the plum pudding and everything. And Edith really loved Charlie. Charlie was really good to her. She was the only one who showed Edith kindness. And so when Charlie died, Edith got really depressed and ultimately committed suicide. And now there is this paradox where Charlie is crossing paths. Like, Edith Thompson can't be alive if Charlie's, or she can't be dead if Charlie's alive.
Yes. So the fact that she has landed in 1906 means that, like, she is alive. So the sequence of events, it's like it's established within her own timeline that she does not die in the R01 event. So the sequence of events that eventually would occur to cause Edith to kill herself can no longer occur. And so she is both, it's kind of like Schrodinger's scullery maid. It's like she's both alive and dead at the same time. And that time paradox is what creates Edward Grove, the manor that she's the scullery maid in 1906, to come alive with, like, the energy that has been generated by that paradox and has created that time loop from 10 to 12 and is sort of feeding off of the energy of that time loop.
Schrodinger's scullery maid would be a much worse title for this story.
Yeah, that was the working title of the original. It's like, no, Chimes of Midnight, we'll just take it from Shakespeare, it's fine.
Yeah, much more evocative. Yes.
The copyright laws was not a thing in the year 1600. It's okay. No.
All right. But yeah, so the Doctor winds up confronting the embodiment of Edward Grove. The physical manifestation, like, takes over Mr.
Shaughnessy.
And they have their, you know, Doctor villain, like, kind of standoff. But in the other story of that episode, Edith Thompson and Charlie are confronting and learn the whole history of everything. And Charlie starts to remember her. And what happens, like, the psychodrama of those scenes is so intense because you know, on one level, it's like, oh, we're introducing a character we never knew about who was really important to Charlie or something. That sounds on paper like that's a lazy writing tick, right?
Yeah.
But Robert Shearman uses it as the theme here, which is that this was just a woman who Charlie was nice to as a kid because Charlie is a nice person.
Yeah, and she gave Charlie plum pudding.
Yeah.
Right? Like, just like, here's some, like, candy kid. And so it's like the kid's going to respond positively to that and never really thought about it. Because, like, it's important to mention, like, Charlie is... Like, she's not nobility, but she's from a more, like, well-to-do kind of wealthy family.
Yeah.
And so she's sort of the heiress of the Pollard family, and she decides, fuck that, like, fuck all these, like, bullshit gender roles, I'm gonna go off and be cool.
She doesn't have all those airs about her, and so...
But she is from the family that's, like, upstairs. Right. She is not part of the downstairs.
No, but she is... Someone from upstairs showed Edith Thompson kindness. This meant a lot to Edith. You get the sense that Edith... you know, is dealing with some issues from her life as is glimpsed in the 1906 scenes.
Yeah.
And when Charlie disappeared, Edith felt so terrible. She took her own life because she felt like there was nothing worth living for. And the way those scenes play out, on one level, there's such a balancing act going on here. Because on one level, you are explaining the very complicated mechanics of this story and doing it in a way that makes very clear sense. Like, at no point is this story confusing in a bad way. Sometimes it's mysterious. It's not confusing, right? But more importantly, it works as this, as I said, psychodrama, because you are in the mind of someone who is really depressed and untethered and hurting in Edith Thompson. And it is such a great guest character for this story of hearing that pain come across and hearing, you know, why she has done what she does, and then how she kind of invites Charlie to do that same thing, and then Charlie has to start to reckon with the idea that she is both living and dead because of her encounter with the doctor. It's really a dynamite set of scenes. The way it is intercut is absolutely masterful. And then, you know, the finale, the climax, where the doctor gets through to Charlie and, you know, tries to offer her his friendship again and make her see reason and not kill herself the way Edith did, and hopefully save Edith as well, is just just gangbusters. It's a great climax.
Yeah, because it works on every single level it needs to for the story. Like, works on the character level, it works on the drama level, but then it also, like, it says so much about the themes of that, because that's where it gets, like, serious, like, really serious, because it'd been sort of spooky and mysterious up to that point with the weird time loop and all, like the characters playing these weird different roles and shuffling around. You're like, what the fuck is going on? This is kind of creepy. But there's also some, like, funny lines in there. But then it kind of all comes to a head where you, like, really understand the plight of Edith and, like, what she actually went through and all, like, the consequence of all this, like, repeated abuse and harassment she's suffered for literally her entire life, that this tiny little show of kindness from Charlie, a kindness that Charlie herself never really noticed or paid attention to, was, like, you know, this hope, like, the only, like, light of hope that she had in her whole life as this, like, older cook and maid in this house. And as soon as Charlie is gone, and, like, gone for good from Edith's point of view, her life is over because nobody else pays attention to her. Like, nobody in the household cares about her. Like she makes the plum pudding and nobody gives a shit because it was like Charlie was the one, like, she made it for Charlie. And, like, her whole life unravels because it becomes that thing of she is just unseen by her society, by her peers, by the people she works for. She is this unseen, unknown person to everything, and nobody can survive in that scenario. And so it's the way they lay that out, it's like becomes very, like, convincing and, like, weirdly reasonable that it's like Edith kills herself, because it's like the reasoning for it is so impactful and so powerful and speaks so much to the themes that the stories have been building up to about the sort of replaceability of the help, and that, you know, their individual identity is not significant to anybody else, and then they can be whoever they want. Like, you can throw this fucking driver out on the street and get a new one in there because it doesn't fucking matter. That is not a society where, like, or that is not a situation in which people can survive in a society. Like, that's not reasonable. That's not fair. That's not just. It's just cruelty.
We've talked a lot about a lot of different dark Doctor Who stories on this series, because I think you have a particular appetite for them. I do too. It's one of the best modes of Doctor Who.
I mean, yeah, but, like the last one we did just show like a like alien god dissecting a maid, and just for to see what was happening. So you might be right. I might have picked some of the darker ones.
But we've done like Tomb of the Cybermen, Brain of Morbius.
Yeah, that's pretty dark.
Vengeance on Varos, Ghostlight. These are all dark in different ways.
Yeah.
This is dark in another way. This is dark in a very real, like, I mean, there's the creepy, like, kind of, you know, par for the course Doctor Who, we're in a creepy house kind of thing.
Yeah.
But there's also the darkness of, no, we're talking about suicide this time. Like, we're talking about the, like, very real, horrific, you know, feelings that enter someone to take such drastic action in their lives. And, you know, I don't think there's a lot of Doctor Who stories that deal with something that real, because in a show that, you know, goes on for 50 years and is about a fun, you know, time-traveling dude and his friends, like, you can't do that too much, right? Like, you can't go to that well a lot. It's also, it's, you know, it's why companions don't constantly die, that sort of thing. It's just, it's not something you can interact with all that much. But I think Robert Sherman finds a really graceful way into it here. And it was stunning. It really was a stunning turn to hear. And the whole way it's resolved with the Doctor kind of invoking Charlie and his adventures up to that point is cool. And it really does feel by the end like you've not just heard a great Doctor Who story, but, you know, in the ongoing plot of the Eighth Doctor's run, a real key turn has been made.
Yeah, yeah.
It feels like there are repercussions. Like, I wanted to immediately go on and listen to the next one. And then I was like, oh, I missed a couple before this, and one of them has Nicholas Courtney, so I'm going to go back.
Yeah.
That's Minuet in Hell, which I haven't heard yet, but I'm excited.
Yeah, that one's interesting.
It's got Nicholas Courtney.
It's got Nicholas Courtney. That's all I care about. Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, any other thoughts on kind of how it wraps up here?
I think we covered it pretty well. Yeah, it's a great fucking story. I want to talk about the characters.
Yes,
and run down the cast of characters. So where do you want to start, Jonathan?
I mean, we've covered a lot of, I think, the side characters pretty well. Are there any others to mention from the non-Charlie Doctor characters?
They have, like, Mary has one of my favorite lines, going back to the humor in the whole thing, which is after Frederick is killed, probably by suicide, almost certainly by suicide, being run over by his own car.
Yes.
Inside of the house, which is the best death. It's so ridiculous. Some of those deaths just get absurd. And there's that whole bit earlier when the Doctor's interviewing Frederick, and the Doctor is realizing the weird sort of, like, inconsistencies in the timeline, and that, I forget what the two cars are, but it's basically, like, it's like a Mercedes and a Bentley or something like that. And one of them, like, it's like, no, the Mercedes was, like, I thought it was supposed to be 1906. The Mercedes is from 1930. And it's like, oh, no, it was a Bentley. The Bentley. And so then later, when he's killed by the car, Mary, like, falls to the ground, cradling Frederick in her arms. It's like, oh, how ironic that you'd be killed by your own Mercedes. Or Bentley. I don't remember which.
It's great. Like, because they start, all the characters start incorporating the inconsistencies the Doctor and Charlie have been pointing out to them.
Yeah.
And so, like, by the time you get to the end of, like, episode 3, some of what they're saying is so absurd, and even they are starting to be aware of it.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, so all that stuff is good. I think, like, all the performances are really good.
They are.
They've all got great, they have a great range of different British accents on display.
They do.
As is appropriate. My favorite is probably the accent that Mr. Shaughnessy has, played by Lennox Greaves. Of course
that man's name is Lennox Greaves. Of course.
Right, yeah.
Of course.
It's very good. Yeah, but then, of course, I think from the non-main cast, the star performance is Louise Rolfe as Edith Thompson.
Yes.
And particularly once you get to, like, that, the revelation at the end, she's so good at delivering, like, this sort of almost, like, ethereal version of Edith that exists outside of time, that, like, remembers these, like, multiple lives and stuff.
Great performance.
But let's talk about the core duo of the episode, the Doctor and Charlie. Which one do you want to start with?
Charlie, Charlotte Pollard, I've only heard 3 and change stories with the Doctor and Charlie. I think she's one of the best companions ever. Like,
give
me a couple months to hear more of it, and I might go higher than that. Like, India Fisher is so good. She and Paul McGann are as well cast opposite together as any two Doctor companions have ever fucking been.
Yeah.
Like, utterly amazing. And I just think, like, she brings, in part because her, I think, I also think this about Paul McGann, like, both of their voices are so perfect for radio.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would love for the physical Paul McCann, he gets to be on TV, I'd like to see that. He would almost be wasted having a body to use because his voice is so good. And like, you know, I haven't seen India Fisher, so I have no idea. Maybe she'd be a great physical Charlie Pollard too. But like, again, just the voice is so great and is so evocative. You can just see the clothes Charlie wears without any descriptions.
Yes.
Because you just know when she says, I'm an Edwardian adventuress going to Singapore, like, you know who she is.
Uh-huh.
And I just think, like, her inquisitiveness, her, like, energy, her also, like, she is slightly distrusting of the Doctor in some ways, even though they are buddies. And I think that's an interesting thread through a lot of their early stories. It's a fascinating dynamic. She is a great character. It's an amazing performance. And, yeah, if you like good Doctor Who companions, you should go seek out some Charlie Pollard.
Yeah, I 100% agree. It's something that, like, across the board, it's one of the best parts of Big Finish Doctor Who is they are so good at making companions. I think mostly because they are willing to go outside the normal pool
yeah.
that you do. That is like, and part of that is like not having to cast for TV means that you have a wider pool of actresses you can look at anyways. So it's like they have a wider pool of talent to bring in. But then also they're willing to write really different characters. So it's like you can have a Charlie Pollard who is not like, I feel like I say this every fucking time we talk about Doctor Who, but it's such a critical thing. You can't have every single character be a like attractive 20-something young like London contemporary woman. Like you just can't do that for everything. It's fine every once in a while. It's particularly good when you're doing a big reset to sort of like do your sort of like standard companion template and have her be modern and all that stuff. But having her be from this specific time period does so much to give a lot of color and flavor to her character, and India Fisher is really good at playing with that, and Charlie has such a rich, interesting history to her of being from this very sort of like wealthy, well-to-do family that she rejected and ran away from, and there's sort of issues of privilege and stuff that come into play in this story and other stories about like the fact that she could do that, and like she could just decide to do that, but then there's also, you know, her issues with sort of the oppression of gender from her time of like not being able to break outside of like the little gender bubble from the early 20th century and say like, I want to be an Edwardian adventurer, and that's like not something that a like nice young lady can't go and run away on the R101. You have to disguise yourself as a boy, which she does in that story. And so all of that stuff is so interesting and compelling, and it's a fun character, and it also is calibrated perfectly to the Eighth Doctor. And it's like one of the reasons why they're so good together is that this is just like a character tailor-made for him. And it makes so much sense that the Eighth Doctor would say like, fuck it, I'm going to break the laws of time. She's way too cool. This lady is super cool. We're going to go on adventures together.
I mean, it is honestly like pretty rare in Doctor Who history that you get these kind of scenarios where a companion is made for a new Doctor at the moment of his or her introduction. You know, we're going to get that, speaking of her, with the 13th Doctor. We'll see how that works out. But, like, you know, you get it with the Third Doctor, which didn't work out great. I like Liz Shaw, fine, but she's no Joe Grant, you know?
Sure, yeah.
And you would get that later. You know, the Fourth Doctor, Sarah Jane's already there. The Fifth Doctor, his whole weird cast is already there. Sixth Doctor, he has Perry already there. Seventh Doctor, they got around to it with Ace, but she's not there moment one, right?
Yeah, no, you have Mel.
Yeah, you know, new series, you have like Ninth Doctor and Rose, which is really good.
Yeah.
Tenth Doctor and Rose, not so much. 11th Doctor and Amy was great.
Aces, like then that's yes, just that's this kind
like
of thing.
This like, kind of thing, yeah. And then 12th Doctor had Clara carried over, and as you often get, it took a little adjustment time to make that as good as it was going to be.
Yeah.
Which was pretty fast, but yeah, it's like, it's interesting. But this is totally, yeah, that kind of Amy 11th Doctor model or something, where you really got to decide, like, not just how we're going to calibrate these. It feels like the characters are made in tandem, but also then the stories they wound up telling with them are very much, you wouldn't tell them with the 8th Doctor and some other random companion.
Yeah, no, yeah. And I have the utmost respect for India Fisher, and her like performance is just stellar. I think like she's great in this story, she's great in all the stories. Again, like it's like I wish I could just like recommend you go listen to Scherzo, which I can't because it's too clear. Like it's so tightly tied to the main story and everything that's like it would be nonsense if you just listen to it out of sequence. But when you build up to it, like her performance in Scherzo as being this sort of like two-hander with the Doctor is so unbelievably good, and it's the kind of thing that is a feat of performance and writing and everything, and yeah, Charlie is one of the best companions, hands down.
Yeah, I've been making the list, because Scherzo is the one I've always heard of and I want to build up to. It's not that deep into the Eighth Doctor's run. It's like his ninth or tenth story.
You can definitely get there. For sure.
We're not recommending, like, there are, like, hundreds and hundreds of Big Finish stories. You don't have to listen to 100 of them to get there.
No, yeah.
Thankfully. But let's talk about Paul McGann.
Let's talk about Paul McGann.
He's so good.
He's so good.
What did we do to deserve this man as Doctor Who?
Not enough, because again, like he's the best audio doctor. I think he's just amazing. But also, I want his face on like a big billboard,
yes.
And him to have like a big budget Doctor Who movie to be in, because he's like, he just fucking deserves it. You know,
he does. That, you know, maybe that's what they should do. They should do a fucking theatrical movie so that we can have something called Doctor Who the Movie with Paul McGann in it that is good.
They should call it Doctor Who the Movie 2.
Yes. That's Doctor Who's second movie.
Yes, Doctor Who the second movie.
No, but Paul McGann is... It's not quite like a Peter Capaldi, where Capaldi has this whole other career before Doctor Who. But Paul McGann is reasonably famous outside of Doctor Who.
Yeah, like, absolutely, yeah.
His first movie ever is one called With Nail and I, which is one of the most famous independent films of the 80s. Like, absolutely beloved movie. He's in lots of other stuff you'd probably recognize. If you look at his, like, TV credits, he's all over British television. You've seen him in different places. You know, you've heard his voice. But he is like this extremely natural fit for the Doctor. Like, if Doctor Who had been on through the 80s and 90s and everything without being canceled, I think he would have been cast as the Doctor either way. I think he just would have been in the pool, and it would have been like, if you read Paul McGann for that part, it would be a really natural pick. But he then had to take this kind of circuitous route to it of doing the shitty movie, which really didn't understand the Doctor in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And then Big Finish came in and said, you want to try this out? And it turned out, you know, just on the power of that voice alone and some very savvy writing, you had one of the best incarnations of the Doctor, bar none.
Absolutely. And it's just, he's got this, there's such a calm confidence to his performance of the Doctor that I adore. And it's something that he, almost kind of like Peter Capaldi in some ways, he has like this very underplayed performance as the Doctor. He doesn't like get big and over the top. It's like when he's giving the big speeches as Doctor Who, they don't always, like, he's not like giving the big speeches. Like, it feels more like he's talking, and he just has this very sort of like natural groove as the character that's so interesting. It's a very different kind of performance as the Doctor from others, but
he's really different.
Yeah, he's really different, and it's something that's like, I think it's one of those things that like one of the things that makes the movie very weird is that it feels like he hasn't found the groove for the character yet. The writing hasn't found the groove for the character. You can see the twinkle is kind of how I always feel about it. It's like you see that there's something there that he has it, but it's when he is able to have these stories that he can perform like Storm Warning immediately. It's just, he immediately grabs hold of that role.
What?
And I like that they keep a lot of like the weird sort of like things of the eighth. He has all these weird sort of like running jokes and habits he has of like talking about the web of time, which is this big romantic way of referring to the time vortex and stuff. And he's constantly name dropping. He has that very like literary thing like you talk about, which comes around in one of my favorite sequence of stories where they have his companion be Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein, which is maybe my favorite novel. And so that's like the Silver Turk is one of the best Eighth Doctor stories. It takes a while to get there if you're just listening to the main range, but like all that shit is so good, and he's so fun and weird and romantic, and he has that dashing quality to him. But he also, and it's not particularly like on display in Chimes of Midnight. You maybe get hints of it, but he does have a very like compelling sort of that dark side of the Doctor as well.
Well, you know what I think of it as, and again, I haven't heard as much, but I do generally know where his story goes because I've looked into it a little bit,
right?
Because the Eighth Doctor goes on one of the wildest adventures any Doctor has canonically gone on.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely, yes. It gets fucking nuts.
And part of that is just, they had this freedom where he is the canonical Doctor, 96 to 2005, and then they're not done with him after 2005.
No, yeah.
But like in that era, they tell this big epic story with him, and part of it, I think, is they're unshackled. It's like Doctor Who is canceled. It's off TV. And what I always think of with the Eighth Doctor, listening to him on audio, is that he's kind of the mature Doctor here. Like, the Doctor has had seven incarnations, he's gone through a lot of shit, and he's kind of rested at Paul McGann, who is, it feels like up to this point, maybe the most just in his being confident about who he is and what a lot of his abilities are. And I'm sure that gets complicated later on from what I've heard.
Yeah.
But like, it's a really interesting thing where he just carries himself with that, again, that swashbuckling romantic overture, but also, again, it's just, I think of this kind of confidence. He doesn't feel like he's bumbling around the universe in the way some doctors do. He doesn't feel like he's having to put on really dark or mysterious airs the way some doctors do. He just kind of is who he is. And of course, that opens them up to go some places with him, like a Chimes of Midnight.
Yeah.
Which I think you could tell with other doctors in broad strokes. I don't think it would work as well. I think it's very tailored to Paul McGann.
Yeah, and it's like what you said with the scene of him deciding, we're going to cash out. Like, this is too much. We're leaving. That's a hard scene to play because it's, like, not a normal scene for the Doctor. And it is something that, like, it's particularly unsettling because he is so unfazed by everything. Like, he takes everything with, like, you know, a smile and, like, a half step that's just like, waha! Like, let's go, Charlie. Let's go have fun. Let's go have a big adventure. And he has that attitude to him, that sort of swagger to him, that when he faces something that's big, it is also very telling that he then has, like, this sense of core sort of, like, responsibility to say, like, no, this is when we leave.
Yeah.
Like, this is, and there's something about also the way he plays that moment that even though we've never seen the Doctor do that before, it gives you this, like, window and this inkling of, like, he's maybe done this before. Like, he's had, like, he's decided, like, I'm leaving. Like I know when this is too much, and we have now hit that point on the meter, and it is time to bail,
yes.
Basically.
Here's another thought I've had about how to describe his performance.
Mm-hmm.
Every Doctor has to play, you know, a funny, charming side of the Doctor. Like, the Doctor always has to be a funny character,
yeah.
You know? Even if he's not in on the joke like, you know, maybe a William Hartnell is, you know? But William Hartnell's Doctor still makes us laugh in places.
Yeah.
But, like, generally every Doctor has that funny side, that charming side, that very, you know, the side that makes you want to go on adventures with him. The Doctor also has to be world-weary and scary in some ways. They have to be prodigiously intelligent. I know we've had debates on is he a genius or not, but compared to everyone else in the room, he's usually very intelligent.
Yes, at the very least, he is, like, the beneficiary of, like, millions of years ahead educational systems than what we have. So it's like, it's whether or not he's a genius or not isn't even the point. It's
right.
Like, we wouldn't even be able to tell because of, like, the background he comes from.
Yep. But you have those sides. And, you know, I think the Doctor, I think, who maybe does those turns in, like, most iconically is probably, like, Tom Baker, who can go from being just such a funny, silly Doctor to, if he has to throw down with the villain, he will get dark with that person.
He will kill them with cyanide gas, as we very viscerally discovered in this series.
But, like, Modern Who does this very starkly a lot of the time, where, like, you'll have, I think a lot of with David Tennant and Matt Smith, where they'll be very silly and fun, and then it's like, you know, usually low angle, they'll tilt their head, they'll get really dark and angry.
Yes, like,
and stuff.
The lighting is so that it's like the shadow falls over their face,
And there's nothing wrong with that. I think Paul McGann is unique in that those turns are imperceptible with him. It is all just one Doctor, and when he is funny and charming and everything, that's Paul McGann. And when he is showing off prodigious intelligence, that's Paul McGann. And when he is getting kind of dark and intense with sequences, you never feel the moment where it shifts. And maybe some of that is it's just voice and you don't do the physical stuff with it, and he doesn't have to think about that part of the performance. But it is incredibly smooth. Like, he just incorporates that intelligence into it so much. Like, I don't think he could do any of the second or fourth Doctor thing where, like, he passes himself off as an idiot.
Yeah.
The eighth Doctor could never do that. He is, but he's also not incredibly, he's not like a professor either. He's just like this guy out there who is clearly really smart, but also doesn't dangle it over your head.
Yeah.
I just think the way he takes a lot of the Doctor's contradictions, because that's the challenge of every Doctor, and that's the fascination of every performance, is how do you incorporate the contradictions of Doctor Who into one character? And they've all been successful at that in very different ways. But the way he does it is really amazingly seamless to me.
Yeah, it's like, it's that kind of thing of, obviously, there's like a huge amount of training and work and artistry that goes into it, but he makes it look easy or sound easy. It's just like, it sounds like this completely just like natural, flawless performance. He just like stepped out of the car and started talking to a microphone. It's like, fuck, man, you're Doctor Who. Like, holy shit.
Yeah, again, as I said, if, you know, if things were different, if there had never been the 96 movie, if there had never been Big Finish and Doctor Who was coming back in 2005, I think Paul McGann probably would have been on the list for Russell T. Davies.
I agree.
And he might have been too big an actor at that point. But, like, I just, at whatever point they were casting this, he's one of the most, kind of like Peter Capaldi today. Like, Peter Capaldi was going to play Doctor Who someday.
Yeah.
If they had the money for him. It's just one of those scenarios where there was an actor out there and it's like, that's Doctor Who. Obviously, that's Doctor Who.
Yeah.
I'm glad he's alive to play Doctor Who.
Absolutely.
So, Paul McGann is cool. I can't wait to listen to more of his stuff. Any parting words on the Eighth Doctor and the world of audio dramas?
They're awesome. Like it's such a great storytelling form, the radio play.
I love it.
And yeah, it's so sad that like it makes sense that it's not like a big popular widespread thing, because like TV is much sexier than radio plays could ever be. But it is not an art form that just needs to die off. And so yeah. I'm very happy that companies like Big Finish are keeping it alive and sort of like experimenting with that form.
I think I've said this before on the podcast. I'm a huge Douglas Adams fan, right?
Oh, right.
Who
yeah,
we've
yeah,
talked
yeah.
about on Doctor Who before, because he wrote for Doctor Who, did City of Death.
Death, which we talked about.
The best version of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is the one least Americans have heard, which is the radio dramas.
Yeah.
Like, if you have... They're not dramas, they're comics, but you know what I mean. If you have never heard Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy in its original radio form, you have never seen Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It is better than the books, the shows, the movie, any of that. Like, it is where that was born to be. And you should go back and listen to it, because it really, I remember hearing that for the first time and it being, because I'd never really listened to a radio drama or a radio play, and hearing it being like, this is a completely valid alternative to these other visual forms of storytelling we have. And in some ways, in the ways that make it unique, it is superior, because there are some things it can just do better, as there are things TV can do better than it. But like, it is a special medium, and Doctor Who is very well suited for it also. So
yeah, because like one of the things that it is like almost feels like the perfect intersection of things for Doctor Who, because one of the reasons why I've never gotten into Doctor Who novels is I am so in love with like the performances,
yeah,
particularly for the Doctor. Like it's just so a necessary part of Doctor Who to me. Like I've tried to reread some Doctor Who novels. I've tried to read some Doctor Who comics. I'm actually interested in reading. Russell T. Davis and Stephen Moffat have both done novelizations of some of their own stories. Russell T. Davis has done one for Rose, and Stephen Moffat has done one for The Day of the Doctor. And I want to read those, but it's like it's hard for me to get into a Doctor Who novel or a Doctor Who comic book, because it's like even if that looks like David Tennant on the comic book page, it's not David Tennant, and it's like, I love those performances so much. It's such an essential part of what, like, kind of sells me on Doctor Who. Like, I can buy into the ridiculous, weird, nonsensical, like, sci-fi fantasy bullshit of Doctor Who, honestly, mostly on the back of, like, the unbelievable performances of the main character. And so, that is such a core thing for me. But then also, you know, the TV setting is really restricting for the kinds of stories that can be told. So if you have the performances from these great, great actors, and you can also, like, explore these, like, endless spaces of imagination, like A Chimes of Midnight, or all of my favorite Eighth Doctor stories is Chimes of Midnight. Another one is Natural History of Fear is so fucking good, and Scherzo is so fucking good. All three of these stories are ones that would be, like Chimes of Midnight, I could kind of see a TV version of. Fucking Scherzo in Natural History of Fear would literally be impossible to do. There's no way you could, like, you'd have to completely change the story to ever do it on TV. And that sort of, like, merging of those two elements makes, like, audio kind of the perfect format for Doctor Who.
Awesome. So maybe we'll talk about more Doctor Who audio at some point. That would be fun.
Yeah.
We'll see. For now, Sean, I think we're going to put this Doctor Who miniseries, we're going to cancel it. We'll retire it for a little bit.
Yes, it needs time to rest. This was the season finale, I guess, is the way to think about it.
Yes, and I think we accomplished our first set of goals, which was to do a story for every classic Doctor.
Yeah, do this broad survey and talk about the history of the show and put things into context.
I think we've done that. Again, we will not be done talking about Classic Who. I think we're going to reconvene and figure out maybe how to do it in the future, maybe incorporate it more into the main show, the Weekly Stuff podcast, things like that. I am also, as you know, if you hear the main show, I'm moving soon to Iowa City for my PhD program, so I've got a lot going on.
Yeah.
Summer is busy anyway, so
we were late on this episode anyway.
We were late on this episode, so it's going to go on the back burner for a while. Doctor Who is never not something we're talking about. So
that's
it'll,
very true.
It'll come up again. And I'm sure there are lots, I know there are lots of avenues for us to talk about. But for now, I think we're going to, this series, I think we set out what we planned to do. Got through 9 Doctor Who stories, 8 Doctors plus an extra 4th Doctor story.
And you agree with me that was very necessary for the 4th Doctor, right?
Oh, fully.
Yeah. Like, now that you've been on the other side of it, you understand it would have been impossible to pick only one. And irresponsible to pick only one.
So, Sean, while we're here.
Yes.
What were the 9 stories? Let's review them again. They were the Aztecs for the first Doctor.
Yes. Tomb of the Cybermen for the second Doctor. It was...
The Demons.
Yes, the Demons for the third Doctor. It was Brain and Morbius and City of Death for the fourth Doctor. It was... Kinda, or this Kinda, right? Yeah, not Snake Dance. I get those two titles messed up all the time.
For the Fifth Doctor.
For the Fifth Doctor. Vengeance on Varos for the Sixth Doctor. Ghost Light for the Seventh Doctor. And finally now, The Chimes of Midnight for the Eighth Doctor.
Okay. What's your favorite of those stories?
Fuck you. Fuck you. You can't just spring that on me. Like, the easy answer would just to be go with, like, Tomb of Cybermen, because it's Patrick Troughton, and I love it.
Because I want to say, Kinda I was a little meh on, although I'd like to revisit it. Those are not at least eight top-notch, like, A-minus to A-plus, generally A-plus stories. Some of those, like, I mean, certainly those first five. Aztecs, Tomb of the Cybermen, Demons, Brain of Morbius, City of Death, A-plus, 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 A-plus.
Yeah.
You know, Vengeance on Varos, I would give maybe a minus two. Ghostlight would be an A or an A+. Chimes of Midnight is an A+. Here's the thing. We could do this series like a couple more times and generally still have A+ episodes.
Absolutely, yeah.
Especially if for like Fifth and Sixth Doctor, we just decided to do Big Finish. Mm-hmm. And we did like, you know, Jubilee and Spare Parts or something.
Yeah.
So those are... I'm not going to make you pick a favorite, I guess, if you don't want to.
Because I will say, I think my top three, in no specific order, would be Tomb of Cybermen, City of Death, and Ghostlight.
Interesting. Okay, let me do my top three, then.
Okay.
That's good.
Yeah.
I think that's better than having to pick...
Yeah, because it's like meaningless to try to pick one.
Oh, ooh.
It's pretty hard, huh?
It is hard. Heart of Hearts, I'm just going to go with my gut here.
Okay.
I would do the Aztecs.
Okay, yeah.
So that's a phenomenal story.
Real fucking good.
And so different than any other Doctor Who you're going to see today. The Demons, because it's got my boy John Pertwee.
Yeah.
It's got Roger Delgado.
Uh-huh.
And it's got Evil Satanic Rituals. It's got Joe Grant, my favorite companion. I mean, Demons is kind of like all my favorite Doctor Who things in a blender.
Yes.
And then I would probably pick City of Death, because it's amazing and perfect. And it's Douglas Adams and Tom Baker, all my favorite funny people doing stuff together. Yeah. I love it. With Chimes of Midnight as my honorable mention of those three.
Yeah, that would be the same for me. Chimes of Midnight is an honorable mention.
But you really can't go wrong. Like, again, maybe Kinda was the one I liked the least, but if you said Kinda is my favorite of those, I'd be like, you're weird, but cool.
Yeah,
it's a good story.
Kinda fucking swings for it, man. Like, it goes for it, which is something I can't say about a lot of Fifth Doctor stories.
Yes. No, you can't deny the ambition. God, those are a lot of good Doctor Who stories. A lot of good memories.
Yep. I have enjoyed doing this tremendously.
Oh, absolutely.
It's been so much fun.
And it's, you know, it's inspired me to start watching more classic Doctor Who. It's great. Yeah.
It's great. Classic Doctor Who is great.
But Sean, now I'm going to ask you the real question to end this.
Okay.
Definitively, who's your favorite Doctor?
Fuck you.